Well, I'm going to apply today some of the ideas that I developed abstractly yesterday to the actual symmetries of the strong interactions, and then, at least at the beginning, and then go on to some related topics. And I first want to say a little about so-called isospin symmetry. Isospin or isotopic spin, and the term came from the fact that iso is from isotope and spin is because it's mathematically identical to the group theory that we have for rotations in quantum mechanics. It's an approximate global SU2 symmetry of the strong interactions. Now, when I say the strong interactions, what I mean is we have these different interactions and they have different symmetries associated with them. And we're now talking about the strong interactions. And approximate means it's not an exact symmetry. There are some, the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian is almost invariant, but there's a small explicit breaking term. And the breaking is at the 1% level. And this symmetry has been known for basically since the discovery of the neutron in the 1930s. The proton and neutron have, under the strong interactions, have almost identical properties, except that the neutron is just a little bit heavier by about 1.5 million electron volts. Also, the proton and neutron are called baryons. They have some conserved quantum number called baryon number, which is 1 for these and -1 for their antiparticles. The pions, the 3 pions, again, are almost degenerate. The pions, the charged pions are a few MeV heavier than the neutral one. And then there are lots of other strongly interacting particles that occur in multiplets. For example, the so-called kaons, there's a positive one that's a little bit lighter by about 1% than the neutral one. These are also have baryon number 0. And then there are anti-kaons. The pions are their own antiparticles. These symmetries can be described by an SU2 group, and obviously the proton and neutron will be in the two-dimensional representation, as are the kaons. The 3 pions are in a three-dimensional representation, etc. I mean, the pi plus and pi minus are pi 1 and pi 2 and pi 0 are Hermitian fields, and so there's really 3 of them in a triplet representation, but it's convenient to put the fields together in this form to create the pi plus state and the pi minus state, or pi plus and pi minus field. And if the sign here puzzles you, remember that the pi plus annihilates the pi plus state, and so the pi plus state comes from taking the pi plus field adjoint acting on the vacuum. Another little word of warning, in quantum mechanics, when one talks about Clebsch-Gordan coefficients for spin for SU2, the spins that transform as a triplet have an extra minus or plus sitting out in front of these, and all Clebsch-Gordan coefficient tables are based on that Condon-Shortley convention, whereas in particle physics, one simply doesn't define an extra plus or minus here so that these are just directly adjoints of each other. I just mentioned that because someday if those of you who go into particle physics will be doing some isospin problem or some SU3, and you'll just not get a sensible answer, and then try to remember back that the Clebsch-Gordan tables have a different convention. Okay, now it's not an exact symmetry, and it's certainly broken by electromagnetism. Obviously, the proton and neutron are totally different under electromagnetism, as are the pi plus minus and the pi zero. But so the interactions are completely different. But in addition, electromagnetism generates just a Coulomb-type self-energy for the charged particles, which tends to break the degeneracy. And that's the dominant effect for the pi plus, pi minus, and pi zero, why the charged ones are heavier. It actually gives the wrong sign for the proton, neutron, and the kaons. It's also broken explicitly in the strong interactions. When I rewrite everything in terms of up and down quarks, it turns out that there's actually a small difference in mass between the up and down quarks, and the down quarks are actually a little bit heavier. They're both very small, but the down quark is heavier, and that's why the neutron and the K0 are heavier. And if one's thinking about just strong interactions, one usually describes this as a strong interaction breaking of isospin. Actually, the masses are in the full standard model. They're generated by the Higgs mechanism in the electroweak sector. But when you're talking about strong interactions, one refers to it that way. Now, to illustrate the interactions, I want to just write down the Yukawa model. Which was explored extensively in the 1950s as a real theory of the strong interactions. And so one introduces a doublet of proton and neutron fields. And I will just write psi to represent the doublet. And one introduces the triplet of Hermitian pion fields. And you can put them together in this way to make the pi plus and pi minus field. And I'll simply use psi and pi to represent these multiplets. Then the, and of course pi, I should have written pi zero is the third one. Under SU2 isospin, the representation matrices for psi are just the Pauli matrices divided by 2. That's a spin 1/2, or the two-dimensional representation. And the representation matrices for the pions are the adjoint representation. And so and L3 is diagonal. That is, L3 is tau 3 over 2, so it's diagonal, plus or minus 1/2. In the pi 1, pi 2, pi 3 basis, L3 is not diagonal. It's anti-symmetric. However, if you rewrite the L3 in terms of the pi plus, pi minus, and pi 0 basis, it is diagonal with L3. Third component is plus 1 for the pi plus and minus 1 for the pi minus and 0 for the pi 0. The finite transformations that correspond to this are, well, I'll write that in a few moments. Well, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. To some extent, it's a matter when you're first encounter a problem, you usually encounter it, deal with it in an awkward way, and then you realize, oh, I could have, if I defined some basis or convention this way, it's simpler. And so people eventually find the simplest way to write it. As a, when it comes to things like spin zero fields, it is almost always simpler to work in a purely Hermitian basis if you're doing any formal manipulation, whereas if you're trying to do a calculation, it's almost always simpler to work in the basis like the pi plus pi minus. Okay, let me write down the Lagrangian density that is invariant, that was considered, and the Lagrangian density that people considered in the Yukawa field theory is I d slash, I'm writing it in the isospin invariant limit. So for the proton and neutron, it's a common mass. If the mass were different, one wouldn't have invariance, plus some interaction term with strength g sub pi times gamma 5, and I'll discuss that momentarily, times pi dot tau times psi. Let me write the whole thing and then talk about it. And plus 1/2 d mu pi squared minus mu squared pi squared. So mu is the common mass for the pion fields. And then one can have a purely self-interaction between the pions, which is of the form pi squared all squared. So this is the Yukawa interaction for pions and nucleons. Yukawa didn't write it that way. He was just doing the potential. But I mean, this is what people called the Yukawa model in the 1950s. The g sub pi basically is the, there is some amplitude for a nucleon to absorb or emit a pion that's proportional to this g sub pi. So it's an interaction strength. There's also a gamma 5. Gamma 5, did you ever see gamma 5 defined last semester? It's, or last term? Gamma 5 is a Dirac matrix. It's I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. And it plays two roles in physics. And anytime you talk about fermion spin, it involves gamma 5. And anytime you talk about parity, there is a gamma 5. For the moment, that's not my topic I'm interested in. So let me just not get into that right now. And maybe I'll comment in a couple of minutes about that. Pi dot tau is sum I equals 1 to 3, pi I tau I. Let me write it this way. And this is just a 2 by 2 matrix that I introduced yesterday that's convenient. The elements of this are the various pion fields. And the 1 over root 2 is just a conventional thing. I could have put a 1 over root 2 here and a root 2 here, but at any rate. So you see that by writing it in this matrix form, first of all, it sort of displays the different interactions of because you've got proton pi 0 proton, you've got proton pi minus neutron. You've got a number of different vertices there, and they're all sort of nicely summarized just by replacing psi by this two-component spinner, psi bar by its spinner, and writing out the matrix. You relate all of the interaction vertices. So the symmetry not only says that they're common masses here and here, but it relates the interaction vertices. Similarly, there are self-interactions involving the pions that are of order lambda. And the self-interactions here, it depends which pions there are, but it's all encoded in this particular form. So pi squared is pi I summed from 1 to 3. And in fact, it's convenient to rewrite this in terms of this matrix as well. Trace of pi dot tau, pi dot tau. So just take product of two of those matrices and take the trace of the product, and that is actually a way of writing pi squared. And recall that the trace of tau I, tau j is a half times the Kronecker delta, and then you can immediately justify this. Okay, this form, well, you can prove that this is invariant in a couple of ways. It should be fairly intuitive, and in fact, one way of that the SUN group was actually can be defined is the group that leaves invariant something like psi dagger psi or pi squared. So it should be fairly obvious that this form is an invariant. This is invariant. This is invariant. This is invariant. And the invariance of this can be proved two ways. The straightforward way is to just show that Ti commutes with L0. The only terms that are at all non-trivial is this one and, well, I guess maybe this one. But this is the only one that's non-trivial. And it just comes about by calculating it. We wrote down yesterday the commutator of the Ti with the individual pi's and the individual psi's and psi bars in terms of these matrices. And it's straightforward. That'll be one of the exercises this afternoon. However, the trick that I introduced at the end of the hour yesterday makes it very obvious that something like this is invariant, because one can actually eyeball it. For a finite transformation, psi goes to e to the plus I beta dot tau over 2. Psi bar, that's like the adjoint, so that goes to psi bar e to the minus I beta dot tau over 2, since the taus are Hermitian. And the pi dot tau we saw yesterday, or I stated yesterday, and you will actually show it in another exercise this afternoon, this actually goes to e to the plus I beta dot tau over 2 times pi dot tau times e to the minus I beta dot tau over 2. So clearly, psi dagger pi dot tau, I'm only focusing on the SU2 parts, not the Dirac matrices and so forth at this point. There's implied the gamma 0 and the gamma 5, et cetera, but I'm just not writing that. It's fairly obvious. So if I said dagger, you get an e to plus I beta, and I guess I must have written it the sign wrong there. No, I wrote the sign correctly. I get an e to the minus I beta dot tau over 2 times e to the plus I beta dot tau over 2. That's the identity. Similarly, this times this is the identity. And so that's clearly invariant. Similarly, in this form, well, we just get the pi dot tau clearly goes into goes goes into, again, e to the I plus I beta dot tau over 2 pi dot tau squared e to the minus I beta dot tau over 2. You can insert a minus and a plus thing between the two matrices if you want. And then that's not invariant, but when you take the trace of this, that is invariant, because with the trace, you're allowed to commute the elements and put this one on the other side so that you get 1. So you automatically have a invariance for this form. Any questions? Okay, so people extensively developed this field as a field theory, and the problem is it's not really perturbative, because you really need g sub pi to be a border around 14, as I mentioned previously, and so obviously it's not perturbative. So this model is a good sort of illustration of the symmetries of isospin, but it's not a good model for actually doing calculations. There is a second symmetry in addition to SU2 that is built into this, and that's baryon number. And I wrote down the actual charges up there. In addition to SU2, well, the symmetry is really the SU2 of isospin times a U1 symmetry called baryon number symmetry. And when I write something like this with a subscript B, the B, it's not a mathematical or group theoretical thing. It simply means the application, physics application, is to something called baryon number. This is an additional symmetry in which psi goes to e to the I alpha psi. Psi dagger goes to, of course, psi dagger e to the minus I alpha, and pi I goes to itself. Or another way of putting it is that each field, phi, goes into e to the I times its baryon number, alpha, times that field. And the baryon number for the proton and neutron is plus 1. For the antiparticles, it's minus 1. And for the pions, it's 0. There's clearly a symmetry of this form. And in fact, baryon number is conserved, as far as we know, in nature. It's probably violated at some tiny level. We'll probably all decay away in 10 to the 35 years by some tiny baryon number violation coming from string theory or something. But as far as we've actually measured, it seems to be absolutely conserved. And this baryon number conservation simply says you can take a proton, can go into a proton, or a proton can go into a neutron if you absorb a pi minus, or a proton, an antiproton, can annihilate to make a pi zero, but you can never change the, here we have a baryon number 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0. So it's a conserved quantity, just like electric charge. In this example, it's sort of automatic, or, well, it's not totally automatic, but it's equivalent to just saying that it's like a fermion number. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
So the baryon number cannot be seen as a subgroup of SU2.
No. The baryon number is not a subgroup of SU2. Nor is it a simple, well, I guess in this example, I think you could be viewed as an extension of SU2 to U2. But more generally, that's not the case. One can do explicit breaking. One could write that L is equal to the thing I wrote there, plus a perturbation in which the perturbation does not respect the isospin symmetry. Now, one could put perturbations in any of the terms here, 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 and here, just extra terms that don't respect the symmetry. But I will focus on the mass term for the proton and neutron. And one could, for example, write this as minus some small number epsilon, some small mass epsilon, psi bar tau 3 psi, for example. And that is the same as minus epsilon psi p bar psi p minus psi n bar psi n, which would mean that the proton mass would be m plus epsilon, and the neutron mass would be m minus epsilon. And by choosing epsilon to be, well, in this case, a small negative number, you could explain the proton neutron mass difference in terms of this. And there could be, as I said, however, there's actually also electromagnetic contributions. If you did this, then you no longer have the full symmetry that you started with. This is, by the way, just the Zeeman effect. It's like when you have a spin a half particle in a magnetic field, there's a degeneracy of the two spin states, but now you turn on a magnetic field in the Z direction, a small one, then you get a small splitting between the states. This is exactly the same thing. What I want to emphasize is that this is actually not a bad model for the breaking. And in fact, both isospin and the SU3 eightfold way, in nature, the splitting seemed to be mainly in the masses and not in the interactions. The interaction terms actually seem to have a higher degree of symmetry, better symmetry than the masses. And that's explained very nicely in QCD, but it was initially just an empirical fact. Okay, so if you do this in the presence of that, then SU2 cross U1b, we say, is broken, and the residual symmetry is this U1t3 cross U1b. That means that the T1 and T2 generators are not really symmetries, because these T1 plus or minus iT2 can, you know, are T1 plus or minus T2 are like raising and lowering operators that take you proton into neutron. But the T3 and baryon number are unbroken. T3 is plus a half for the proton, minus a half for the neutron, and there's nothing in that term that violates the symmetry. Yes?
Just a clarification in L dot. How does the matrix multiplication work in the gamma 5 pi dot tau term?
Okay. I was going to just turn to the, say a little about the gamma 5, but what you have to keep in mind here is there are two spaces of indices. Well, there's really three spaces of indices here, buried in here. You have the SU2 indices, you have the Dirac indices, and the Lorentz indices. And they are completely separate spaces. Matrices act on different spaces. And so you're not multiplying. This is like, for example, this is a matrix in Dirac space, this is a matrix in SU2 space. You don't multiply those matrices directly together. They're acting on completely different indices. That's why it's usually least confusing if you suppress all of the indices except the ones that you're interested in. So here I've suppressed the Lorentz indices, and I have suppressed the Dirac indices. But let me just, for example, where do I want to do it? psi bar del slash psi, being more explicit, is psi p bar alpha, psi n bar alpha, where I've written out as a row vector the SU2 states, and I put the alpha, that's the Dirac index. And then the d slash is gamma mu, which has implicitly an alpha beta, times d by dx mu. And then I have psi p beta psi n beta. So here I have explicitly displayed all three spaces of indices here. Okay.
So in the pi 1, pi 2, pi 3, are they scalars or are they Lorentz vectors?
These are spin zero. So let me just say a digression for a second about that gamma 5. And space reflection should be really denoted R, but it's usually denoted P for parity. Refers to a discrete symmetry, space-time symmetry, which classically is a position goes into minus itself and a momentum goes into minus itself. And a classical system may or may not be invariant under this. It's a mirror image sort of thing. Now, these quantities are called vectors. And vector has actually two meanings if you're just talking about rotations and not worrying about space reflection. Then vector simply has the familiar meaning. It's got three components and it rotates like a regular vector. But when one's talking really about the full possibility of space rotations plus reflection, a vector means not only is it a rotational vector, but it goes into minus itself under reflection. There are other quantities, notably angular momentum, which is x cross p, which goes into itself under reflection. So the quantities like this are vectors with respect to ordinary rotations, but they're not vectorial in the sense of that minus sign. And these are called axial vectors. Or sometimes pseudo vectors. Similarly, x squared and p squared are called scalars because, well, that means under rotations, they're left invariant, but it also means that under reflections, they go into themselves. So again, scalar has two senses. If one's not talking about space reflection, anything that's invariant under rotations is called a scalar. But when one's being more specific, including this, then something like L dot P, which goes into minus L dot P, is called a pseudo-scalar. So it's something that's odd under space reflection, but even under ordinary rotations, invariant under rotations. It turns out experimentally that the pions, when you extend all this from classical physics to field theory, the pions are pseudo-scalars. That is, their properties, their interactions are such that they must go into minus themselves if you make a space reflection. And in terms of field theory, psi bar gamma 5 psi is a pseudoscalar. So it's basically, you could put it crudely, the pion has spin 0. It could have had an interaction without the gamma 5, or it could have had an interaction with the gamma 5, or it could have been some linear combination. Experimentally, the gamma 5 is there, and then we can code that by saying pi is a pseudoscalar, and it couples to a pseudoscalar current. Just for completeness, scalar current would be something like psi bar psi, a vector current something like psi bar gamma mu psi, and an axial vector current is something like psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 psi. Yes?
Does the Lagrangian have to be a scalar?
Does it have to be what?
Does the Lagrangian have to be a scalar?
A scalar? It does if nature, if you want to have rotational invariance for your theory, yes.
As opposed to a pseudoscalar.
As a what?
As opposed to a pseudoscalar.
Oh, the all that really, I believe that all that really matters is the relative terms in the Lagrangian. Okay. So that's all I wanted to do on the SU2. Are there any other questions? And by the way, I'm not going to pursue this business any more. If you want to learn much more about this, there's a whole section in my textbook about all of these things in field theory, and we'll come back in some sense to it when we do weak interactions next week. Okay, what I want to do now is just comment briefly on the extension to SU3. There are many more particles around than just the pions and nucleons. And already in the late 1940s, in cosmic ray experiments, these kaons had been discovered. And the kaons were very strange. And they were called strange particles because their properties were strange. Namely, the kaons, even though they're very massive, you could, for example, have k plus go to pi plus pi 0, for example, but it does not happen rapidly. I said on the first day that the typical strong interaction resonances, if a decay was kinematically allowed, it typically would decay in 10 to the minus 22 seconds or so. Well, in fact, these particles don't decay in 10 to the minus 22 seconds. They do decay eventually, and this happens, but it's like 12 orders of magnitude slower. And so the point is that these new particles, strange particles, would be stable if you only had the strong interactions. It's only the incredibly tiny perturbation from weak interactions, which we're pretending don't even exist at this point. They're the only thing that make it decay. On the other hand, and so this could be explained by having, there was also, however, associated production. You can certainly have something like, you could have pi plus pi minus could scatter to produce k plus and k minus. So this particle has strangeness 1, strangeness minus 1. So it was realized that you could assign some new quantum number called strangeness to all of the particles, and that could account for the conservation of strangeness, would prevent a decay like this in the strong interactions, but allow associated productions like this. And in fact, there are many strange particles, and I'm only going to list a few of them here. So for example, there were spin and a half particles called hyperons, or sometimes just baryons, which are similar to the proton and neutron, but include strange particles. So what I'm going to do is just make a little grid here. Here's the proton and neutron, and these have strangeness zero. But then there were, and the two of them in this direction is just the isospin, the third component of isospin, plus a half and minus a half. Then there were an isospin triplet of particles with strangeness minus one called the sigma hyperons. And then there was another one called the lambda, which also has strangeness minus one, but which is an isospin singlet all by itself. And then there was something called the cascade particle, and zero and minus, which is an isospin doublet, and with strangeness of minus two. So these were all observed. And this nice pattern was part of the eightfold way of Gell-Mann and Neumann in the early 60s. And it came because they realized that particles like this could be classified under an SU3 symmetry. SU3, remember, has two diagonal generators, two conserved quantum numbers. One is isospin, third component of isospin. SU2 is a subgroup. And then there was a second one associated with the eighth component. And that's actually represented by strangeness here. Or I'll improve upon that in a second. And I think from earlier courses, you'll recognize that this is just a weight diagram of, or a root diagram of SU3 with the two axes on it. Yes?
The last line, are they both the same particle?
Minus. Thank you. Then the antiparticles form a separate octet. This is, of course, called an octet, the baryon or hyperon octet. There were similar things observed for the mesons. There was the K plus and K zero that I already mentioned, which have strangeness plus one, and the three pions, with strangeness zero. And then there's something called the eta here, which is a SU2 singlet, isospin singlet that also has I3 of zero and strangeness zero. And then you have the anti-kaons, K0 bar K minus, with strangeness minus one. So the anti-kaons, they're in the same SU3 octet, but in different SU2 multiplets. Now these all have baryon number one, and these have baryon number zero. And the reason that the strangeness is not the same in the two is because the actual quantities are, there's something called strong hypercharge. Which is baryon number plus strangeness. And it's really the strong hypercharge, well, the The third component of isospin is the one we really identify with the T3 and the hypercharge, strong hypercharge up to a normalization is the one we associate with the T8 generator of SU3. So these have strong hypercharge 1, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, minus 1. And just to complete this, for all of these particles, the electric charge is always this I3 plus strong hypercharge over 2. That's not true when you extend this charm and top quark and things like that, but for all of these particles. So Gell-Mann and Neyman realized that you could classify the known hadrons into simple multiplets like this. And there are others. There's 10-dimensional multiplets and so forth that are also relevant. I'm not going to write all that down. But this led to an enormous simplification of the hadron spectrum. And it realized also that there seemed to be a pretty good symmetry. The masses are degenerate to about 25%. So actually, it's sort of badly broken. I'm not going to write down all the masses. These, remember, were within 1%. And the splittings here are more like 25%. But still, it's not bad. Here, the splitting between the pions and kaons, if you look up there, is actually much more than that. But these are called the pseudoscalar mesons. These are a special case, and it's actually consistent. The splitting is still comparable to these splittings. It's just that the sort of the zero value is small, and we'll see tomorrow, I guess, a sort of a rough explanation of why that is. Okay, I don't want to develop this any more because I really want to go on to other things. And there is an optional, if you have time, problem this afternoon is actually displayed a SU3 invariant Lagrangian, and in which you're asked to do certain manipulations. There's actually more invariants under SU3 than there were under SU2. But it all worked pretty well. The mass splittings are fairly large. We now understand that because the strange quark is much heavier than the up and down quark, but we're pretending at this point that quarks, we don't know about quarks. The interactions have much better symmetry than the masses. And that, again, is explained in the quark model in which the interactions are actually exactly SU3 symmetric. It's only the masses that break the symmetry. Okay, so I don't have time to develop that, and I need to go on to other things, but are there any questions? Okay, let me comment a little bit on the extension of these things to quarks. A couple of years after SU3, Gell-Mann and Zweig independently postulated the quark model. And basically, the idea is that there are, instead of all of these things and all of the other ones that I haven't written down are really just bound states of three quarks, up and down, which form an SU2 doublet, and a new quark called a strange quark, which is a singlet under SU3. Later, it was realized there's three more quarks, charm, top, and bottom, but we're not talking about that at this point. And the electric charges are 2/3 in units of the positron charge, and minus 1/3. And when I write it this way, I'm emphasizing the SU2 transformations, but you can write it just as a Q is a triplet under SU3. So it's a three-dimensional representation. The 3 and the 3 star and were not made use of in the eightfold way, but they is made up, made use of in the quark model. And sometimes you write it as Q1, Q2, Q3. And this transforms as e to the I beta dot lambda over 2 times Q. So the electric charge matrix acting on this three-dimensional space is this from this relation. I'm just rewriting it explicitly for the three-dimensional representation. Indeed is 2/3 minus 1/3 diagonal with zeros in the other locations. And the hypercharge matrix is lambda 8 over root 3. And this is equal to 1/3 times 1 minus 2. And on a weight diagram, one has y equals 1/3, y equals minus 2/3, and here's uds. And the anti-quarks are just the opposite, s bar and u bar and d bar. And so these transform as a 3 star. And one could account for this whole spectrum. You have to include spin and orbital angular momentum and so forth. And one could basically account for the whole spectrum, including not only these, but all the heavier hadrons and the spin 3 Habs resonances and everything. In fact, there was one that was predicted by this classification to complete a 10-dimensional multiplet that was discovered were predicted. All I want to write down now here is the Lagrangian 4 non-interacting quarks. Would be just a sum over U, D, and S of A equals U, D, and S of Q bar A I D slash minus M A Q A. I'm allowing different masses for them here. And this can be rewritten as Q bar I D slash minus M0 Q. M0 is sort of a common mass that would be, this term is called L0. This is what you would have if there were no SU3 breaking. And then you can rewrite the other terms are M3 Q bar lambda 3q minus m8 q bar lambda 8q. This term will mimic the SU2 isospin breaking term that I wrote down earlier, but at the quark level. And this term mimics I'm going to call this L3 and L8. This term will mimic the SU3 breaking. The masses that occur here are, well, MU is M0 plus M3 plus M8 over root 3. MD is M0 minus M3 plus M8 over root 3. And MS is M0 minus 2MS over root 3. So if you have three distinct quark masses, you can rewrite it in terms of an SU3 invariant term, a term that breaks SU2 and which actually transforms like an element of an octet of operators under SU2. Remember, in quantum mechanics, anytime you break a symmetry, it's important to know how the symmetry breaking term transforms. And this transforms like an octet of operators, the eighth component of the same octet of operators, and it's called coefficient times L8. In QCD, one will have a structure like this. There will be an additional interaction associated with gluons that's completely SU3 invariant. And it's only these quark mass terms that break all these symmetries. And the whole thing works out very well. And this was remarkable because this structure formally, in terms of the octet of operators, et cetera, was all understood phenomenologically prior to the quark model. But there it was just a sort of very clever abstract inference, whereas here it's just comes out automatically. Any questions? Okay, just bear with me for a couple minutes more, and I just want to introduce one further concept. And you can see what I'm doing this week is mainly just putting down all the ground, you know, background necessary to develop the full structure of the standard model with all of its symmetries. There's another concept that's critical called chiral symmetry. And I'll be brief on this. For fermions, I have been talking about four component Dirac fermions with a Lagrangian, free Lagrangian psi bar i e/-m psi. And each of these has four components. For an electron field, for example, you have a left-handed electron, right-handed electron, left-handed positron, and right-handed positron are associated with psi and psi dagger. However, one can introduce something called psi left, which is p left psi, psi right, which is p right psi, where p left is 1 minus gamma 5 over 2 psi, and p right is 1 plus gamma 5 over 2. These are projection operators . These project out the left helicity and right helicity. Remember, left helicity means the spin is opposite the three momentum of the particle. Right helicity means it's along. And these actually project out those helicity states for the particle. And it's actually the opposite for the antiparticle. These are, you probably started out in your field theory, of course, with vial spinners rather than Dirac spinners. Is that the case? Or did you have vial spinners? These are two component objects because I projected out two. There's only two remaining. They're sort of two-component objects, even though they're in a four-dimensional notation. But two of them are automatic components or zero. So these are actually vial spinners. And of course, psi is the sum of them. So a four-component spinner is just a sum of two vial spinners. One can take these vial spinners as the independent degrees of freedom. They are really the independent building blocks. And the psi is a construct added later, putting them together. One can think of them as independent. And since I've run out of time, I'll leave it as an exercise to show that the L0 psi bar left I d slash psi left plus psi bar right I d slash psi right plus or minus m psi bar left psi right plus psi bar right psi left. I leave it as an exercise for you to show that when you make this decomposition, the kinetic energy terms preserve the chirality. This is really chirality operators. Helicity and chirality, by the way, are only the same in the massless limit. So these are better called left and right chirality. The kinetic energy terms conserve chirality, but the mass terms take right into left. A chiral symmetry is one in which psi left and psi right transform in a differently. When I talk about SU2 and SU3, I implicitly assumed that, you know, psi proton and psi neutron, that the left and right were transforming the same way. But they're really independent degrees of freedom. And you can have a psi left and psi right transform differently. Here, for a single field, I could have psi left goes to e to the I alpha psi left, and psi right goes into psi right, for example. This would be called a chiral transformation. They're transforming in a different way. They have a different charge under this U1. Or I could do the same thing even for an SU2. I could have an SU2 group in which the psi left for the proton and neutron goes into e to the I beta left dot tau over 2 psi left, and psi right goes to e to the I beta right dot tau over 2 psi right, in which these beta left and beta rights are completely independent vectors. So they're transforming differently. That's called a chiral symmetry. From this example, you can see that fermion mass terms do not allow chiral symmetries. In this U1 case, if I have a fermion mass term, then obviously this is not a symmetry. So generally, I don't want to state it as an absolute theorem, but generally it means if m equals 0. If you've got massless fermions, then you have generally chiral symmetries, and massive fermions do not have chiral symmetries. You only have the subgroup in which beta left is equal to beta right. This concept was introduced again in the 1960s because it was realized that these Flaber global symmetries of the strong interactions really were a subgroup of a larger chiral symmetry group associated with the fact that especially the up and down quark are very light. They play a much more important role in the weak interaction. You can begin. Yeah. In the weak interactions which violate parity and under which the psi left and psi right are completely separate transformations. The left-handed fields transform under the SU2 weak, the right-handed ones don't. And that's parity violation. That means that you cannot have the SU2 of the weak interactions, you can't have fermion masses. And so just like you can't have gauge boson masses, you have to generate them some other way, and that's the Higgs mechanism. But I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's why I introduced this concept. Okay, finally, then tomorrow I will introduce the Goldstone theorem, the notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then having done that, I'm not going to do the Higgs mechanism until later, but I will introduce the Goldstone theorem and then finally QCD. So, okay, final questions?